sort of, you're in pen face world right now, right, for the next hour and a half. And David brought you there a little bit yesterday, too. So Marlene was talking about systems level network supporting face recognition, looking at this sort of higher order level. I'm going to be talking a little bit about trying to do some coarse grain feature representation to drill down into some of these regions we've been talking about, trying to understand more about what the underlying representations are like, or begin to talk about that issue. I don't know exactly what David talked about yesterday, but I presume, knowing David, that he talked some about, who knows what David talked about. Some of the more fine grain levels of neural representation for these kinds of issues as well, at a very detailed level. And then Isabel's going to be talking about the dynamics of acquiring features and how task is a particular kind of role. And I think there is some nice continuity. Without us actually, it shows some of the integration that's happening, because I think we didn't plan it. But as you'll see, my talk is very consistent with a lot of the things Marlene was talking about, and then it ends with about issues about how task is critical in face recognition. That leads right into what Isabel's talking about. So somehow it all works. Okay, so just quickly, this is really based on Adrian Nestor's thesis work. That's what I'm presenting here, to give credit where it's due. Okay, this is, some of you have seen this picture before. For that, I'm sorry. For those of you who haven't seen it, what is this? Okay, and what is it? A carrot, what? Car, thank you. Okay, it is Richard Scarry, yes. And so, you know, I sort of became struck at some point a couple years ago when my older son was 3. I started reading Richard Scarry. I'm like, we know exactly what this is right away. And it's a very striking fact about the way our visual system works, that we're able to put together lots of things that we know something about and recombine those features in new ways. And it's a story that a lot of people have talked about for a long time, about the compositionality of cognitive systems and thinking about that. But I thought that it really sort of struck me that when we think about the problem of object recognition, that problem, the problem of how we put together and reuse features and parts and what features are as the sort of basic predicates or building blocks of what it means to recognize and know about objects, is sort of a big open question at this point. And I sort of, because of that, I sort of stepped back in my work and I've been thinking a lot about what it means to have a high-level feature in visual representation. And sort of, that's a sort of open question that we run into all the time, and I found it frustrating about a lot of my own work that I couldn't answer that question at all. And I don't think I'm going to answer it at all here, but at least give you some ideas of where I'm going and what I'm thinking about. And, you know, the other thing I became struck by is I worry that this is our current state of theories of high-level vision. That you've got lots of stuff coming in, it says here, and then a miracle occurs, and you've got somehow things coming out. That we know a lot about early vision, and we know a lot about categorization, and the end product, and behavior, but that most of what's happening, sort of, as Marlene showed it, from that sort of posterior to anterior connectivity, what's really happening there at a computational level is still, well, relatively unknown, particularly in terms of the kinds of representations we have. So that's the goal here. Now, people say, oh, come on, we know all this stuff from Keiji Tanaka. You look at his work that he did in physiology, and he did these kind of image reduction techniques where he took some complex object and he reduced it down to see what was the best stimulus that still drove an individual IT neuron. You say, well, we know what the features are like. They're these kind of weird intermediate little blobby things. But there's a lot of issues about the way Tanaka did that work, and it's not something that people have really pursued, so I don't think we really have a coherent answer to that question at this point. Some limitations he himself raised about these kinds of things is he said that he didn't really cover the space of what the most effective features may or may not be, so his starting point might have been somehow idiosyncratic, so he might not have been sampling things in a reasonable way. And he also sort of the time available to continuously record from a single cell. And so, and as he, like he says, it's the imagination of the experimenter. But that raises a couple issues. More recently, there's work by Ed Connor's group. They've been doing kind of a different kind of data reduction technique. They have these objects, and they do a kind of genetic algorithm where they generate sort of these descendants from them. They'll pick the one that the neuron likes the best, and then they'll do the descendants of that one and go down that genetic tree to try and pick the sort of contours that are best coded for by a given IT neuron. And I think that's beginning to get the right kind of idea. There's some issues about the way they do the search algorithm and what they choose as their initial starting set, but it's at least the kind of direction I think we'd like to try and go ultimately in the field. Now, this is all in neurophysiology and IT, and to be clear, I think that doing neurophysiology is a really critical part of solving these problems, but I'm also concerned that there's some critical issues that are going to lead to neurophysiology never being able to answer some of these larger questions about the kinds of intermediate features we have. And one of the issues I worry about is undersampling. That a single primate cortex is about 10 to the 9th neurons in higher level visual areas, and sort of back of the envelope, I figured out there's about 10 to the 6 recordings total done across every monkey physiology lab in the entire history of the world that we know about, unless the Greeks were doing things we didn't know about, that have been recorded with all different kinds of experiments and stimuli and so on. So it's really hard to capture the kinds of feature codes going on here with this is our sort of sampling of the problem. So I worry that, while it's one approach, it's not going to be, it can't really be the whole approach for various reasons. And the second thing is, and this is something that was alluded to in Tanaka's work, and it really goes back to Charlie Gross and all the original IT work, it's like, how do you figure out what a neuron is selective for? Well, you show it a toilet brush, and it turns out that that neuron likes a toilet brush, and you've got your toilet brush neuron, so for those of you who know Charlie Gross's work, or you show it a lot of other stuff that you have laying around the lab, or these days you have a graph, you have your image set that you buy from somewhere, and you show all these different images that you happen to have from your collection of Google images, but there isn't a really systematic way of searching through image space and looking for things and trying to reduce those down. And I think it's a goal of a lot of physiologists as well as people that are me who do human imaging, is how do we have a more effective search? And the Connor approach was one, the genetic algorithm was one way of trying to do that, but it's something we really need to come up with ways if we're going to map and understand what the feature coding is at the intermediate level, is how do we come up with models for identifying intermediate features and selecting among them as we search through the space of all potential features. So these are just two issues with physiology and in general how it challenges the problem. So, yeah. Yeah, and presumably David showed his little dancing dot pictures yesterday, and yeah, those are getting to more dynamics to me. Like that would ultimately be a goal too. And I'm not even close to thinking about that, how we might do that in imaging, but we mean to think about more ways that we could do that. It's certainly and also embedded in contexts and scenes too, as opposed to white backgrounds. So there's a lot of different issues that all come out. So I'm going to talk about two experiments that use fMRI because that's the tool I use in human cortex, looking at human cortex, to try and understand something about the kinds of visual features that may or may not be used in face and object recognition. I'm going to focus on face recognition. It's very consistent, again, with the things Marlene was talking about, but I really assume that the same kinds of techniques could apply widely to object recognition. And it's nothing about faces being unique. So the first experiment is one about trying to come up with an assumption-free model for looking at what kinds of features people might be coding, and I'll explain in a second what that means. The second experiment is about how we can manipulate features with respect to the given task. And I think that leads nicely into Isabel's talk. Okay, some of you may be familiar with a technique called noise-based reverse correlation. Essentially what you can do is it's a kind of way of using people's tendency to top-down hallucinate things in the world and using that tendency as a tool for sort of diagnostically understanding what features are and what critical features in the image is that they're using to identify things. So, as one example, if you've ever been in the shower and you're waiting to hear the doorbell ring or you're waiting for the phone to ring, the noise from the shower or other noise, the fan, leads you that has some of the components that are actually in the doorbell ring or the phone ringing, and you actually hallucinate and think that you're hearing these things and they're not true. And if you have your cell phone, I'm convinced now that people often grab their cell phones because they think they've vibrated, because I think we probably all have leg tremors all the time. And we used to just assume they were noise and filter them out, but now we have this top-down kind of template we're applying because we think it's a cell phone vibrating, and you'll see all these people grab for the phone all the time when it's not vibrating. So I think it's the same phenomena. And that phenomena is exactly what these techniques use, is that they essentially show people noise, but they tell them there's a target in there, and then you're going to basically stack up all the things where they thought they were a target versus all the things where there wasn't a target, and you're going to look and see what kinds of features emerge. So it's assumption-free in the sense that you're not really giving people features. You're not making any assumptions of what features should look like. You're just trying to pull out things from it. One of the biggest problems that requires lots of trials, and you'll see that in a second. And what Adrian and I tried to do is extend this to fMRI and face detection, not face identification, but face detection. So here's what our stimuli look like to give you a sense of what these things look like. We have a very, very low contrast face. And we combine that with a noise field, a random noise field, and you get a base image that has a very simple face somewhere floating in it. It's the same face on every trial, by the way. It's just an average face we used. And we set that so that the subject accuracy was about 70% accurate in terms of saying that there was a face here and this is just pure noise. Okay? And so these are the stimuli we're showing people, and you're just supposed to say face, no face. And the idea is that you're ultimately going to presumably get a stack of images for the case where people said there was a face that tell you something, if you add them all together, about what kinds of critical features were people were using to say that they thought there was a face present in the image. That's the basic idea behind these techniques. Okay, this is a slow event-related design, just some of the other technical details about it. Notice here, this is a critical thing. We have two subjects total in this study. Each one did about 2,000 trials in the scanner. It's about 12 one-hour sessions. Okay, not all continuously. It was 1 hour at a time, but still, okay. And this is typical. This is just enough data to get some of the results we'd like. I mean, if you really wanted to do this cleanly, you'd like way more data than this per subject, okay? So this is one of the big issues with reverse correlation techniques, is they require an awful lot of trials. But props to Adrian for wanting to try it. Very, very simple task. Again, you see a cue, you just see this. You're basically supposed to say, you wait a second, you're supposed to hold your response mentally, and you say, and you actually respond face or no face. And you go on for 2,000 trials. Okay, yeah. And one thing I should mention is we did show our subjects prior to the experiment this template face. The idea being we wanted them to all, there's an issue of registration. If they don't think they know where the face is appearing, they could be using different features that they think are moving around because they could think they're hallucinating a profile in one trial or whatever. So they at least had that, so you get some benefit, hopefully, of registration. Okay, I'm going to skip a lot of other analysis details and things in the name of saving time and can talk about them if people are curious. But essentially, we had these two subjects, EC and EA. These are their raw classification images. Effectively, you can think of these images being what you get when you stack up all of the trials. This is the behavioral data where they said they thought they saw a face versus all the trials they said where they didn't see a face. Okay, this is non-smooth. This is the raw data in both cases. This is if you smooth the data. And then you can do a trick. First of all, you can add their data together to get more power. You effectively have 4,000 trials. And you can also, because you assume that the face is symmetrical, you can actually use your data in a symmetrical fashion that cleans up your data more. Here's that raw data combined across the two subjects and mirrored, and this is what you get if you smooth it as well. And this is just a pixel test showing you which particular pixels are significantly different from base level in either direction. And so you do get a contrast image that looks like a rough template of a face. Okay, this is the behavioral data. Now, the critical thing is what are we getting from the neural data and how do we even collect that neural data? Okay, what we've identified is four regions in a separate localizer in these two subjects that are, again, the usual candidates for being face selective regions, at least some of them. Right FFA, left FFA, right OFA, and left OFA. Okay, those were localized in these subjects in a separate task with normal images and so on. Okay, we're using a particular kind of version of it. We're taking the percent signal change essentially as the response signal when it reaches a particular threshold that's considered to be a hit, that they think that they've seen a face there. When it's below a particular level, we're assuming that they don't see a face there. We're binning the data across all the time courses of the hemodynamic response function, and we're looking at the data in each of these separate regions as a separate set of responses. And from that, you can get classification images again. Okay, so instead of the subject now again saying face or no face, it's effectively that neural region, average of that neural region that we've picked out, saying face or no face based on the strength of its response. Okay. And what you're seeing is across our two subjects. First of all, EC was a better subject for various reasons. But you can see that you're getting in the right FFA something that looks like a high contrast face template. You're getting a little bit of something like that in left FFA and right OFA and left OFA as well. And there might be something there. If you do the exact same kind of combination analysis, you take data from both subjects, you take the symmetrization of it, as it was called, and you put that all together, you actually get different but plausible face-like templates coming out of all four of these areas. Notice that in the FFA you seem to have different kinds of more specific regions that are highlighted versus the OFA, the earlier visual area that seems to be selected for faces. It's a larger contrast area that seemed to be picked out. Okay, now, so this is looking at the data. This is our behavioral data again. This is the neural data from right FFA. Just as an observation, Viola and Jones and other people have looked at where the most information is carried for things like face detection from computer vision sorts of studies, really have identified two high contrast regions, this region right here, the contrast boundary there, and this contrast boundary there, as being the ones that carry the most information, again, for detecting a face. And that's very similar to what we're seeing in these classification images, as if the kind of information that seems to be carried, if you just use an objective analysis, is really what these areas are picking up on for face detection. Another question we wanted to ask was really, well, how good is this template that we seem to have picked up on and that's coded in these particular regions? So we took the following idea. Here's our classification image. This is now the neurally derived classification image. You can construe the most extreme thing of all noise or something as being like an object, something that's not at all face-like. You can take sort of parts of that classification image, just the left part of it, just the top part of it, or the whole image, as being sort of on the spectrum, moving to more and more face-like, where then a full face image is probably the best stimulus. Okay, and we were interested in whether or not face selective regions that we knew to be face selective through lots of other studies were sensitive to this dimensionality here, and where this is expected to be the lowest responses and you might expect these to be the highest responses, and validate whether or not these are relatively similar to these in terms of response, because we've captured the essence of what they're coding for that they're really responding to. Okay, so it's a kind of data reduction technique. Simple design, it's a block design now. We have five conditions, this condition full of objects, again, left classification image, top of it, the whole thing, or a full normal face. And we did 10 control subjects plus our original best subject, EC, which are the best classification images. EA refused to ever go in the scanner again for us. she was willing to bowl through, but she didn't want to do any more. But EC came back in. And so we have her data, this template was really derived from her data primarily, and we have our 10 controls. Okay, here's what we find. We're looking at, again, the four face selective regions, the usual candidates, right FFA, left FFA, right OFA, and left OFA. This here is basically arrayed out objects all the way up to face hood, and you're looking at the percent signal change. The striking thing is, look at EC's data. She's showing higher percent signal change for the face template that was derived from her own behavioral data than she is for full faces. It's small, but it's there. Very consistent for her across all those things. Our controls, on the other hand, actually show that progression where that face template is the next best thing to a full face, but they're still higher for the full face than for the template. Okay. So what does this all mean? Well, first of all, again, I want to emphasize we're talking about face detection, not face individuation. I'm going to get to face individuation in a minute. But it seems like we've tapped into some kind of robust contrast pattern that might be the quasi-invariant face template that might be used for face detection that's emerging out of these areas. When we evaluate the template in terms of the gradation of responses in the classic face selective area, what we actually see is that for the specific observer that was used to derive that, that's actually in some sense a better stimulus than the full face. So there may be something about specific learning and specific experiences of the observer in terms of whatever idiosyncratic things define a face for an individual that we've tapped into. And the reason why the other control subjects weren't quite as high is because theirs is a little bit different. It's probably roughly something face-like, but you might see differences. And so there really may be a role, and that leads into the next study, of task or observer-relevant features that are created as people learn about things, even though there's some general stable properties probably across most individuals. Yep. No, the polarity, yeah. Yeah, no, the contrast polarity there is arbitrary, effectively. But the eyes are darker, but it's really the contrast boundaries, I think, are the critical thing. Yeah, eyes are darker. It's consistent with the actual contrast boundaries in the face, No, the contrast boundary is actually right, yeah. Yeah, it's sort of right in there. That's Isabel's talk, right? We're leading into that. Anyway, okay, so going on to the second experiment, let's talk about a little bit of task-relevant features. So there's an approach that Shimon Ullman has been talking about now for almost 10 years, where he calls it the mutual information approach to doing object recognition. And essentially what you're doing is you can construe a detection task between two object categories is being solvable by looking for the image fragments across multiple scales that are most diagnostic or carry the most information from separating one category of objects from another category of objects, where you're looking across all the objects in one category and all the objects in the other category. And critically, it is multi-scale, and it also allows different resolutions and aspect ratios. So it allows you to find features, essentially, image fragments that correspond to features at any scale that seem to carry the most information for doing a particular task. He construed it for telling, for instance, cars from faces categorization. There's some work that he's done with other people suggesting that behaviorally and electrophysiologically there is some validation that people are sensitive to that information. We're going to construe it in terms of face individuation. And what that means is a little bit different. What it means in terms of face individuation is that you're asking not which features are the best features for telling apart across all members of a category, for telling one category apart from another category, but what features within a given category across all the members of that category are best for telling members of that category apart. So it's where the most information is carried within a common set of objects for telling one object in that set from another object in that set, which is a little different than saying where's the most information for a category carried for telling that whole object category versus another object category. Okay, this is the data set we use. I'll just let you know at this point, I think it's about 300 faces. There's about, almost 40 images per person, including lots of emotional expressions. And people were talking about emotional expressions this morning. We picked this up from Alice O'Toole. If you have people watch movies, you get unbelievably realistic natural emotional expressions. 2 minutes? Oh man. No. Just letting you know it's available. You can download the whole set. And it's also got lots of different viewpoints of the faces as well. And it's also got disguises, which is rather unique if you want to do something with disguises. Okay, just quickly then. We set up two sets of different fragments using the mutual information approach. We had fragments that were optimized and carried the most information for detection, and we had ones for individuation. For detection, we have fragments that carry a lot of information, fragments that carry less information, and fragments that carry lower amounts of information. Again, for the detection task, we've roughly equalized the area across all of these fragments in that set, and we do the same thing for individuation. This row carries the most for individuation, and this carries the least, and again, roughly equated amount of area. Okay. We did a behavioral task to validate that people were sensitive to this. I'll skip. It's just basically a same different task. You see a fragment, see another fragment, you say if it's the same or different person. Okay. What you find is if you look at these fragments for individuation, you get an effect both in reaction time and accuracy, and you get it for detection as well, that the more information that's carried in the fragments you showed people, the better their performance is. So it's just a validation that, in fact, the fragments computationally carry information of varying amounts, and behaviorally it seems to be true. Now the interesting is what happens if you do imaging. So without getting into the details in the imaging study, this is a map. It's a little different than what you normally see in the following sense. This is showing you a comparison between high or low diagnostic fragments. So that's what the subtraction you're doing. So you're looking at areas that seem to be sensitive to the amount of information carried for a given task. Okay, and in the cases here to orient you, the face selective areas, such as Marlene was talking about before, are these bright yellow areas, right and left FFA. Okay, for the detection task, these red areas, those are the areas that seem to carry the most information or most sensitive to the information carried in the fragments for doing a detection task. And then this orange area, of which there's really one, which is an anterior area where you might have identity, it was completely consistent with what Marlene was talking about, seem to be the area where you're most sensitive to the amount of information carried with respect to information for individuation. Now, that's not the whole story. Marlene promised pattern analysis. So here goes. This is a parametric analysis, simple, straightforward subtraction. But we also wanted to do a pattern analysis to see if there was more information being carried in different areas with respect to these tasks than what you could see from a standard GLM. So here's the same data I just showed you in the brain map, but broken down now by the typical face selective regions, the right FFA, left FFA, OFA, right STS, and left STS. Okay, and what you're just seeing here is the average sum percent signal change and whether or not it's significant. And you only see two significant effects. The only place where there's significant responses by a GLM or a parametric comparison is for the detection task in right FFA and right OFA. Okay, which is completely consistent with the standard literature. If you're going to find an effect, that's where you'd find it. And again, this is where is the most information carried with respect to those kinds of features, high versus low. Now, let's do a pattern analysis. In this case, pattern analyses, for those of you who don't know, they're simple linear classifiers. You're actually asking now, independent of a typical statistical comparison, where is the most information carried for a particular classification task? So instead of saying, for instance, that you need a consistent statistical effect, you're just saying some of the voxes could be some could be low, but together they carry lots of information about the particular classification task you're asking for. So here, what I'm plotting is in the same exact five regions that were used here, the exact same ROIs, which of those regions carry the most information for high versus low diagnostic features, okay? And what you actually see is that the right FFA, while it doesn't show much of a response in a standard GLM in terms of the difference between high and low diagnostic features, it actually is carrying a lot of information about that task. It's just carrying a different way. And if you want to get into the details of it, what's really happening is that for the detection task, it's showing a fairly low but heterogeneous response or homogeneous response across all the voxels. And then for the individuation task, it's showing a very homogeneous response where a small number of voxels are on any given set of trials, but together they actually carry a lot of information about telling the difference between high and low diagnostic fragments. And so that's the difference really between a pattern analysis and a standard parametric comparison, is that you can pick up things in terms of the information carry that aren't necessarily would be picked up by a standard statistical test. Okay, so I know I'm going a little quickly here. Let me give you a quick summary. The information that's diagnostic for face detection and individuation seems to be differentially coded. We see some of the same areas end up being recruited, but we pick up on them by different analysis methods, so the differential coding. And in particular, we think that larger identification or configural features are built from smaller detection features. That's not particularly controversial, but that the features in the FFA, we represent the first step in this process that then moves in a more anterior fashion. And that the configural representation of individual faces, I think, then gets consolidated in AIT. What do I mean by that, just a little bit more specifically? FFA, I think, is instantiating localized individual-specific features. That, I think, when we talk about expertise, I think that's what we're actually talking about, is that to be able to tell apart two individuals in a class, you need to instantiate specific features of each of those individuals. You can no longer have generic features for the category. You can't tell people apart unless you have features that are specific to those people. FFA may be coding for those, but in some sense, as Luke said earlier, is a bag of features kind of approach. And what's happening, though, is it instantiates those features, and then holistic processing sort of happens, if you will, and passes the information off to AIT, where you have the individual representation of a person. So AIT is really where you instantiate those more global or configural features and get the idea of identity being coded. So there's this network of processes happening. Just quickly, I'll mention it's very consistent with the idea of configural or holistic processing happening in FFA, that you have these individual features being coded, they're somehow being put together. That doesn't mean that's where they ultimately instantiate as a single individual, but that's where the process starts. And then there's also some data from another student of mine, Jinxia Kang, about neural trade-offs between face processing and other domains of expertise. And it's very consistent with that idea as well, is that as you learn new domains of expertise, you're expecting that some of the features in FFA that presumably were sort of coding for faces because there was nothing else being processed in FFA with any to the level of expertise that faces were, you're going to start to see some of those units being co-opted away, and your overall response to faces should go down as you acquire a new domain of expertise. We actually see that. So if we actually go back to the original Griebel neuroimaging study that Isabel did for her PhD thesis, we didn't think about it at the time, but actually if you look at our training data over the course of acquiring Griebels, the neural response to upright versus inverted faces goes down. Okay. And then in a bird study that Jinxia ran about bird experts, this is on the x-axis here is their bird expertise. On the y-axis, the percent signal change here for birds versus objects. And you see a typical response. The more expert you are at birds, the higher neural response you see for birds in the FFA. And then the interesting thing, and this is two separate studies, and then here's the interesting and weird thing, is that here's faces minus objects where this is bird expertise. So the better you are at birding, the lower your neural response is to faces. And I don't think that's manifesting behaviorally at all. It's a simple fact of the network architecture of the system that these units that were once not being used for anything but face recognition, some of them get co-opted for bird expertise as well. But it's just because you're instantiating now bird-specific features to be able to tell birds apart. Okay, that's it.
Okay. So in your first experiment, when you talked about the template for collection, I'm curious what you mean by that, in the sense that, don't you think if you do the same sort of experiment with a novel objects, but you know, you train people to look for turn pattern, you're going to get data that's going to allow you to get, you know, an image, a template, but you might not think, I mean, so you think it's a template that people create online, or you're not saying there's a face template?
No, I'm not saying there's a face template per se. I'm saying that there's something about the features we're instantiating there in the region we're looking at that effectively is capturing critical information about faces that allows us to do face detection. So, I mean, I'm using template really loosely here, not as I mean
literally. Yeah, and you mean something holistic about this template, because it could be, this could be happening.
The reverse correlation doesn't tell you how that's put together, right, where it emerges from. Yeah. That's it has a lot of limitations.
The template carries a lot of,
I know,
baggage.
And I don't mean it that way, yeah. I just mean that overall it's somehow a neural tool that allows you to do face detection.
Right.
But that's all I mean by that. Rob?
I'm wondering why you presented that face. So why do you present people that face at the beginning of the experiment? I worry that what they're using as their template is just a blurry version of the face that you told them to look for.
Right.
And so that's why it's tailored to that individual. That's why the control group.
Right. So the problem with you, so if you look at all the reverse correlation studies for the most part that have been done with noise models, I mean, the bubbles model has been a little different, but... like Allison Sekulow's actually gone even more extreme. She'll have a single target of like a letter through thousands of trials. But the problem is co-registration. If you don't get good co-registration, if you let people completely unconstrain what they're hallucinating, if you will, in the images, you'll never get anything back. Because you're assuming that you can stack all these things up and recover something, right? But if you sort of say, well, there's a face somewhere there, and you leave it like, it'd be like this or like that or like that, and people assume that and they like look for that, you're lost. Because we're barely getting anything back with 2,000 trials. So we have to acknowledge the method has a lot of limitations. It's just at least it's one assumption-free method being able to look at some of these things. It probably only takes you so far, and that's all it's ever going to do. But we thought it was worth a shot for doing that.
Thank you, Mike.